I seem to have lost the original question here.
Well, it's hard to keep God on one subject. I am kind of expansive. Let's see if we can get back. Okay. Oh, yes. What to do about the less fortunate. First, decide who and what you are in relationship to them. Second, if you decide you wish to experience yourself as being succor, as being help, as being love and compassion and caring, then look to see how you can best be those things. And notice that your ability to be those things has nothing to do with what others are being or doing. Sometimes the best way to love someone and the most help you can give is to leave them alone or empower them to help themselves. It's like a feast. Life is a smorgasbord, and you can give them a big helping of themselves. Remember that the greatest help you can give a person is to wake them up, to remind them of who they really are. There are many ways to do this, sometimes with a little bit of help, a push, a shove, a nudge, and sometimes with a decision to let them run their course, follow their path, walk their walk, without any interference or intervention from you. All parents know about this choice and agonize over it daily. What you have the opportunity to do for the less fortunate is to remind them. That is, cause them to be of a new mind about themselves. And you too have to be of a new mind about them, for if you see them as unfortunate, they will. Jesus' great gift was that he saw everyone as who they truly are. He refused to accept appearances. He refused to believe what others believed of themselves. He always had a higher thought, and he always invited others to it. Yet he also honored where others chose to be. He did not require them to accept his higher idea, merely held it out as an invitation. He dealt, too, with compassion, and if others chose to see themselves as beings needing assistance, he didn't reject them for their faulty assessment, but allowed them to love their reality, and lovingly assisted them in playing out their choice. For Jesus knew that for some, the fastest path to who they are was the path through who they are not. He didn't call this an imperfect path and thus condemn it. Rather, he saw this too as perfect and thus supported everyone in being just who they wanted to be. Anyone, therefore, who asked Jesus for help received it. He denied no one, but was always careful to see that the help he gave supported a person's full and honest desire. If others genuinely sought enlightenment, honestly expressing readiness to move to the next level, Jesus gave them the strength, the courage, the wisdom to do so. He held himself out, and rightly so, as an example and encouraged people, if they could do nothing else, to have faith in him. He would not, he said, lead them astray. Many did put their faith in him, and to this day he helps those who call upon his name. For his soul is committed to waking up those who seek to be fully awake and fully alive in me. Yet Christ had mercy on those who did not. He therefore rejected self-righteousness and, as do I, made no judgments ever. Jesus' idea of perfect love was to grant all persons exactly the help they requested after telling them the kind of help they could get. He never refused to help anyone, and least of all would he do so out of a thought that you made your bed, now lie in it. Jesus knew that if he gave people the help they asked for, rather than merely the help he wanted to give, that he was empowering them at the level at which they were ready to receive empowerment. This is the way of all great masters, those who have walked your planet in the past and those who are walking it now.
Now I am confused. When is it disempowering to offer help? When does it work against, rather than for, another's growth?
When your help is offered in such a way that it creates continued dependence rather than rapid independence. When you allow another, in the name of compassion, to begin to rely on you rather than rely on themselves. That is not compassion. That is compulsion. You have a power compulsion, because that sort of helping is really power tripping. Now, this distinction can be very subtle here, and sometimes you don't even know you are power tripping. You really believe you are simply doing your best to help another. Yet be careful that you're not simply seeking to create your own self-worth. For to the extent that you allow other persons to make you responsible for them, to that extent you have allowed them to make you powerful. And that, of course, makes you feel worthy. Yet this kind of help is an aphrodisiac which seduces the weak. The goal is to help the weak grow strong, not to let the weak become weaker. This is the problem with many government assistance programs, for they often do the latter rather than the former. Government programs can be self-perpetuating. Their objective can be every bit as much to justify their existence as to help those they are meant to assist. If there were a limit to all government assistance, people would be helped when they genuinely need help, but could not become addicted to that help, substituting it for their own self-reliance. Governments understand that help is power. That is why governments offer as much help to as many people as they can get away with. For the more people government helps, the more people help the government. Whom the government supports, supports the government.
Then there should be no redistribution of wealth. The Communist Manifesto is satanic.
Of course, there is no Satan, but I understand your meaning. The idea behind the statement, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, is not evil. It is beautiful. It is simply another way of saying you are your brother's keeper. It's the implementation of this beautiful idea that can become ugly. Sharing must be a way of life, not an edict imposed by government. Sharing should be voluntary, not forced.
But here we go again. At its best, government is the people, and its programs are simply mechanisms by which the people share with many others as a way of life. And I would argue that people, collectively through their political systems, have chosen to do so because people have observed, and history has shown, that the haves do not share with the have-nots. The Russian peasant could have waited until hell froze over for the Russian nobility to share its wealth, which was usually gained and enlarged, by the way, through the hard work of the peasants. The peasants were given just enough to subsist on as the incentive to keep working the land and make the land barons richer. Talk about a dependency relationship. This was an I'll help you only if you help me arrangement, more exploitive and more obscene than anything ever invented by government. It was this obscenity against which the Russian peasants revolted. A government which ensured that all people were treated equally was born out of the people's frustration that the haves would not give to the have-nots of their own accord. It was as Marie Antoinette said of the starving masses clamoring beneath her window in rags while she lounged in a gold inlaid tub on a bejeweled pedestal munching imported grapes. Let them eat cake. This is the attitude against which the downtrodden have railed. This is the condition causing revolution and creating governments of so-called oppression. Governments which take from the rich and give to the poor are called oppressive, while governments which do nothing while the rich exploit the poor are called repressive. Ask the peasants of Mexico, even today. It's said that 20 or 30 families, the rich and powerful elite, literally run Mexico, principally because they own it, while 20 or 30 million live in utter deprivation. So the peasants in 1993 and 94 undertook a revolt, seeking to force the elitist government to recognize its duty to help the people provide the means for a life of at least meager dignity. There's a difference between elitist governments and governments of, by, and for the people.